I'm going to do it this way.
Okay, algebraic geometry and six-dimensional superconformal field theories. So, conformal field theories are a very interesting topic in physics. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the physics behind this, and I'm not going to be very specific or precise, and so I invite the mathematicians to regard this as an informal introduction to something that you might not know too much about. So in general, we have a lot of trouble discussing with any mathematical rigor quantum field theories. Quantum field theories are usually formulated in terms of path integrals over huge infinite dimensional spaces, which are hard to manipulate with mathematical precision. However, physicists study these a lot and have got very effective techniques for manipulating them. And one of the features of quantum field theories in general is that they're scale dependent. And in fact, one of the key techniques for trying to analyze quantum field theories is to try to figure out what that scale dependence is. And so in modern quantum theory, that's discussed by what's called Wilsonian renormalization. And it's simply the following idea. So if I formulate my path integral not as an integral over spatial variables, but if I do a Fourier transform so that I'm integrating over momentum, which is the typical thing people do, then there's a problem with high frequency modes and low frequency modes. And so instead of going all the way to infinity or to zero, you introduce some maybe artificial cutoff to try to understand an approximation to this integral that's not so well behaved. And then you study how the problem changes if you vary that cutoff. And in a very nice class of theories called renormalizable theories, it turns out that the whatever you've put in this integrand will have some kind of coefficients, and you can find a dependence of the coefficient on the scale in such a way that if you change the coefficients according to that dependence, when you change the cutoffs on the integral, you'll end up with the same value of the integral. So you could discuss the same, in the same family of theories, you could discuss a theory at one particular scale or another particular scale as being related by a change in the coefficients of a theory. And so that leads to the following picture. So we have some space of all theories labeled by whatever these coefficients were, and then we have some kind of flow in this space, and the flow is given by a change of scale. So there is a direction to this flow. It's if I have the if I know the theory at high energy, then by kind of ignoring some of the high energy features of it, I end up with a description of the theory at lower energy. So that's the natural, at least for the high energy theorist, the natural direction of this flow. And so this flow describes a semigroup whose name in the physical literature is the renormalization group. But it's a semigroup. And so what I like to use, the term I like to use is RG semigroup. Because RG, the physicists recognize, and they don't care that I'm precise and call it semigroup. So it's an RG semigroup. And so if you wanted scale-independent theories, one place you might imagine finding such a thing, so this is some flow on some nice manifold, and it may be that there are fixed points for the flow. If you had a fixed point for the flow, by the way, it doesn't have to be purely attractive, right? You could have some flow path, get close to it, and then sort of zoom out someplace else. But if you have fixed points for the flow, those will at least be scale-invariant theories, and in many contexts, they will also be conformally invariant theories. So that's one of the traditional ways of trying to think about how you produce a not just scale invariant, but also conformally invariant quantum field theory. Now, the construction that people tend to use for that is they start at high energy, which means in the lingo, in the ultraviolet, or UV, And they start with a free field theory in the ultraviolet. And in appropriate set of dimensions, that free field theory is sufficiently well-behaved or can be made well-behaved by regulation in the ultraviolet that you could imagine adding some small perturbation to the free field theory. And what you end up with is a Lagrangian description of a family of quantum field theories where the coefficients in the perturbation form this parameter space that I was speaking of. There are variants of this where the parameter space itself may be infinite dimensional. You may have a gauge symmetry in the theory, which means that when you're analyzing the theory, you have to only consider gauge invariant quantities. There are a number of technicalities here that I'm suppressing, but this is a basic approach. But this fails in space-time dimension bigger than 4. And so it fails just by analyzing this general scheme of renormalization. And so even though there was some sort of indirect evidence that there might exist conformal field theories in dimensions beyond 4, people, until the first examples were constructed in the mid-1990s, suspected that there probably weren't any of these things. And in any case, they're, whatever they are, they're not going to be able to be described as something like a free field theory in the ultraviolet plus a small perturbation of that theory. But as I mentioned, in the mid-1990s, people realized that there were ways of doing this. And
what does it mean exactly? That means if you start with a free theory with a small perturbation in like dimension 5, and you start...
So the free theory itself is not ultraviolet. It's not well-behaved in the ultraviolet in dimension bigger than or equal to 5.
So you have nothing to start with.
Nothing to start with. But we could try to start with something coming from higher dimension. In fact, something coming from a gravity theory in higher dimension. And the candidate for that are string theories, and the close cousin M theory, which provide theories in higher dimension which have the potential of describing the ultraviolet behavior of these theories. And in fact, that's how people realized in the 1990s that there were going to be such field theories and that there were ways of describing them coming from string theory. So these are 10-dimensional theories. This is an 11-dimensional theory. And what we're going to look for are ways of describing this 10-dimensional theory on some compact space of dimension 4 cross R15, or over here, some compact space of dimension 5 cross R15, and obtaining a starting place for an ultraviolet theory in that way. So there are a number of examples, but I want to focus on one to get us started, but I'll give 3 different descriptions of where it comes from. So the first description comes from one of the string theories known as the heterotic string, known as the heterotic E8 cross E8 string. So what is this? This is a 10-dimensional physical theory. It's a theory that involves gravity and Yang-Mills. So you need a gauge field. And the gauge group for the Yang-Mills theory is E8, again, to be slightly mathematically precise about it, it's the global structure of the gauge group is E8 cross E8, and then you semi-direct with the Z2 that exchanges the two E8 factors. That's not relevant for anything I'm going to say today. So the fact that it has gravity means that there's some Gij. The fact that it has these Yang-Mills fields means that there's some Ai, which has its entries in the Lie algebra E8 plus E8. Okay, so E8's one of the exceptional Lie groups. Hopefully everybody here has heard of its existence at least, and it's going to play a role several times during this talk, so I'll tell you a little bit more about it a little later. And if I'm going to look for something six-dimensional, what I want to do is take that 10-dimensional theory and put it on a compact four-manifold, and there's a natural compact four-manifold to use. The natural compact four-manifold I want to use is going to be what's called a K3 surface, and that is, it has this nice property of having a Ricci flat metric as a Ricci flat Kähler metric. Sorry. So the word super was super conformal was at the beginning. I forgot to say anything about supersymmetry. So I'm interested mainly in conformally invariant theories. In fact, all of the constructions that people have made for theories beyond dimension four are conformal. Are supersymmetric. And so, in addition to the standard translation invariants that and boosts that you would see in a theory that obeyed the principles of special relativity, that's what I'm essentially implying by saying R15, we have some additional structure. We have some kind of algebra of operators which extends the algebra of infinitesimal translations on spacetime to include spinner operators, operators indexed by spinners whose squares are translations. So that is a part of this story, and I think I'm going to manage to not have to tell you too much about it, but it's the presence of that supersymmetry, the continued presence of that supersymmetry, which leads us to seek a Ricci flat Kähler metric on the four compact dimensions that we're going to insert here to get a six-dimensional theory. So when I do that, what I need on my K3 surface is a bundle with some kind of E8 cross E8 structure group, and it's supposed to satisfy some kind of nice differential equation, which turns out to tell you that you're getting holomorphic sections of some bundle. So it's a holomorphic bundle, it's got holomorphic sections, and we start to get into the realm of algebraic geometry. These are complex manifolds. Not all of them are algebraic, but many of them are, and we're studying holomorphic bundles over those complex manifolds, although they're holomorphic bundles that are a little unusual to study in mathematics, because usually we study bundles whose structure groups are the classical groups, like the GLNC or something like that, or if you want to look at the maximal compact in that, the unitary group. Here we're actually wanting, as a structure group, one of the exceptional groups, and that's dictated to us by the very constrained conditions of producing a string theory in 10 dimensions. Okay, but there's one thing you could, an interesting thing you could do when you have a bundle, you can consider a limiting singular bundle on this. So this is, I keep calling it a four-manifold, but the reason it's called K3 surface is that as a complex manifold, it's a complex surface. And there's a limiting type of singularity with a simple point-like singularity at P in X. So I'll call this guy X. So I take a limiting singular bundle with a point-like singularity at P in X. And of course, to approach that, I have varied some parameters in describing the bundle. I probably was also varying at some point in this story the parameters that describe the metric on the K3 surface. Those are finite dimensional parameter spaces, and I have to do those parameter variations to reach this nice ultraviolet theory that has the 60 conformal behavior. So it turns out that these 60 superconformal points that you construct by this or other methods tend to have two different kinds of deformations. And in the context here, we could smooth out the bundle by varying the complex structure that defines the holomorphic bundle. But there's another one, which is harder to understand. So I'm just going to put question mark. So I'm going to present a second description of the same class of theories in which the question mark will be a little easier to understand, but the smoothed out bundle will be harder, although it can be described in that setting as, again, having to do with the structure of a K3 surface. And then I'll give a third formulation, which is going to lead me to my method from algebraic geometry for analyzing these conformal field theories, in which I can see both of these types of deformation quite easily.
So can I ask just a couple of questions? The singularity, is that in the bundle itself or in the connection on the bundle?
It's in the bundle. It's certainly a singular connection.
Okay. Because it might be like all the curvatures concentrated near a point.
That's exactly what's happening.
All the curvatures concentrated. Yeah. And then the other thing I was just curious is the fact that the root lattice for EA cross EA happens to sit inside the integer cohomology ring of the K3 surface relevant.
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yes, very relevant. I won't have time to exploit that in today's lecture.
But is two coffee related to this too?
Yeah, I guess so. It's the,
so it must be related to two coffee there.
Well, K3 has the two EAs.
Yeah. And the three
well, you know, it's the unique even unimodular lattice of rank 8. So it's got, I mean, these things all have to be related. Okay, so my second description of this is a description from M-theory. Well, I'm not telling you too much about the string theories or about M-theory. So M-theory is this 11-dimensional quantum theory of gravity, which we know perhaps even less about than we know about the string theories. But class of theories that you build out of M-theory imagines the 11-dimensional space-time as being bounded by two 9 plus 1-dimensional walls. And so there's one dimension that's singled out as being a finite interval with boundary. And when you study M-theory from that perspective, you discover that there has to be an E8 gauge group. An E8 gauge field which lives on the walls. And there's a beautiful duality, one of the famous string dualities, between this theory and the heterotic EA cross EA theory. In this theory, there's a quantity called the string coupling. And I do not remember the proportionality, but the string coupling essentially goes like 1 over the length. So that a weakly coupled theory will be a theory in which, I think I have the sign wrong. Okay, it goes like the length to some power, and if I say the length to some power and don't say the sign, then the fact that I don't remember won't get me into trouble. But the two EA gauge fields which are required from the point of view of the heterotic string just by anomaly cancellation in the 10-dimensional theory end up coming to you from the structure of M-theory on a manifold with boundary over here, and there's this very nice correspondence between the two sides. So this guy is called, this boundary is called an M9 brain. And then there are other extended objects in M-theory called M5 brains and M2 brains. The way that brains are labeled, this is why there was this question just before the talk started. The way that brains are labeled, they're counting spatial dimensions only. So this is a 9 plus 1 dimensional object, this is a 5 plus 1 dimensional object, this is a 2 plus 1 dimensional object. And as you can imagine, there are going to be interesting six-dimensional theories constructed out of M5 brains in some way. And what I've done here is I've chosen within my boundary, I have to use the same K3 on the two boundaries, and then I have some point at which there's a curvature singularity for the connection, and the additional thing that I can do, well, so the interpretation of that small point in the M9 brain is that the M5 brain, there is an M5 brain which is dissolved in the M9 brain, and you can let it move away. So this question mark direction over here is what happens when you let an M5 move some distance away from the so-called end of the world M9 brain, the boundary of the space-time. So I can't let it move away unless I've created that curvature singularity in the bundle direction. But if I move it back in, then I can deform the bundle and sort of smooth out the effect of the M5 brain into some combined, slightly topologically interesting end of the world brain. So I have those 2 degrees of freedom, which are visible from this particular picture. So these pictures are great, and you can make interesting models. For example, you can put so an interesting way of producing other examples is you can put the curvature singularity of the bundle at a mild singularity of the K3 space. So K3 surfaces have limits which have singularities locally of the form C2 mod gamma, where gamma is a subgroup of SU2, a finite subgroup of SU2. These have an ADE classification. I remind everybody that SU2 double covers SO3, and the finite subgroups of SO3 are familiar since antiquity, quite literally. You have rotation, the rotation groups, you have rotation plus reflection. Those form 2 infinite families. And then there are the symmetries of the platonic solids. And even though there are 5 platonic solids, there's a duality. There are only 3 distinct groups. The tetrahedral, octahedral, excuse me, tetrahedral, octahedral, and icosahedral groups. Those particular finite subgroups. And so we've come to recognize that the rotation groups behave like a family of combinatorial structures, which appears in lots of places in mathematics, known as AN. The rotation plus reflection groups behave like DN. And then there are these 3 exceptional ones, the tetrahedral, octahedral, and icosahedral groups. And if I lift those groups to SU2, I get what are called binary tetrahedral, binary octahedral, and binary icosahedral groups, finite subgroups of SU2, which are showing up. If I take C2, mod such a finite subgroup of SU2, I get a nice singularity. And that singularity has a property that it's got a holomorphic 2 form nearby, which is essentially the one that came from C2, which behaved just as well as the holomorphic 2 form on the global K3. And in fact, the theorem about the existence of Ricci flat metrics extends to K3 surfaces that are allowed to have these kind of singularities, where the metric has to be an orbifold type metric near the singularities. So one generalization is to try to put the small instanton, the quantized singularity in the connection, which is called a small instanton, at a curvature singularity and try to study what happens. So that's a problem, actually, that Paul Aspinwall and I sat down to address in the late 1990s. And the way we approached it was with yet another duality. So there's a dual description of this theory before we think about the singularities in terms of what's known as F-theory. And this is where I really get involved with the algebraic geometry. So I neglected at the very beginning to do the usual thing. So assuming I get there, I'm going to be talking about some more modern papers with various collaborators of mine, which are Del Soto and Heckman and Park and Rudelius and Vatha in various combinations. And here are some numbers, 1512 hasn't happened yet, 5746, 1412, 6526, these are archive numbers, 1502, 05405, and 1505, 00009. So I'll try to say something about what's in some of those papers, although how far I'll get today I'm not sure.
Could you just say sort of the Venn diagram, that is the K3 surface that's in a constant section of that 9 plus 1 edge? Is that right?
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is...
And then what's the relation between it and the 5 brain?
Okay, so... so, if I have a point on K3 in the 10-dimensional setting, then transverse to that point is 5 plus 1 dimensions. And so here, I mean, I don't have enough dimensions to draw it properly.
Yeah, but is the K3 surface at the edge?
So I'm going to use 4 of my dimensions here to compactify the K3 surface. So I've used this dimension to essentially compactify an interval, and I'll use 4 out of these 10 to compactify the K3 surface, leaving myself with 6 free ones. Now, if I mark a point on the K3 surface, then I still have the 6, 5 plus 1 dimensions coming out, and I can move that, I can sort of try to move a 5 brain off. And actually, the 5 brain is sort of counting the second term class of the bundle, so the fact that I had this isolated curvature there is what lets me move it off as a 5 brain. So the dual description in terms of F theory uses another one of the string theories, the type 2B string theory. And the type 2B string theory has a couple of really interesting properties. It has two real scalar fields, but you should think of them as a complex scalar field. But it's a complex scalar field, which I'm going to call tau, which, with an appropriate normalization, has positive imaginary part. There is an SL2Z symmetry of the theory, which acts as fractional linear transformations on tau. Tau goes to A tau plus B over C tau plus D. And if you look at some of the natural objects in the theory called D7 brains, an M5 brain was a 5 plus 1 dimensional object. This is a 7 plus 1 dimensional object. There will be a transverse 2 dimensions. Here's the location of my D7 brain. And in codimension 2, I can sort of traverse a little loop surrounding the D7 brain. And when you do that, you end up changing the value of tau. So this takes tau to tau plus 1. So you're automatically in the situation, if you include any D7 brains at all in this theory, you're automatically in the situation where this complex scalar field is not single-valued but is multiple-valued in some way. So F-theory was this beautiful proposal by Thapa to study this type of string compactification with the allowed variability of the scalar field by using an auxiliary elliptic curve and a family of elliptic curves. And really, when you analyze it carefully, all you really care about are these F and G. So I want to write F and G as functions on the compactifying manifold. So maybe I'm going to call it F of ST and G of ST. And these together determine, by looking at this equation, they determine tau up to SL2Z. So I don't have time to tell that story properly today, but it's a familiar story in mathematics that the natural quotient of the upper half length by SL2Z is the parameter space for elliptic curves. Elliptic curves can be written in with equations like this, where F and G are arbitrary numbers which will determine tau. Now, there is a condition, which is that this star is singular as an algebraic variety if 4f cubed plus 27g squared is 0. And in fact, that's where we're going to locate the D7 brains. The same phenomenon of tau, if you try to define it, being multiple valued as you go around some locus in the parameter space, happens when you go around the vanishing locus of this particular equation. So again, if I have this locus, which is usually called delta, which is where 4f cubed plus 27g squared vanishes, and I encircle this guy in some way, then something like tau goes to tau plus 1 in the correct basis will happen. Actually, if there is higher multiplicity of vanishing at this along this locus, then something more complicated can happen. But if there's just a single order of vanishing at a point like that, then tau is in the right basis, tau is going to go to tau plus 1. So the basic data for considering a six-dimensional compactification for F-theory is, again, I would want my real four-manifold, or it's going to be two complex-dimensional. F, and so I'm going to call it B, which is the base of the vibration. F and G, when you look at them globally, F has to be a section of a bundle on the base, which is minus four times the canonical bundle. So that's a little technical, sorry, if you don't know what it is. But it's just a way of imposing the global condition, which will make sure that I get, as the total space of my family, a Calabi-Yau manifold, which again I need for supersymmetry purposes. So these choices are to go to supersymmetry. And then there turns out to be a very natural model of the point-like instanton, which shows both of the parameters in a very clear way. So I'm going to get to that model in just a couple of minutes. Before getting to it, I want to tell you where the E8 comes from in this theory. So you can ask the question, if this is singular, and if you look in the total space of a family, what do you observe in that total space of a family? So let me mention that Kadaira analyzed that. So Kadaira analyzed behavior in families, one complex dimensional families, the families with the complex dimension of B is equal to 1. And he found that if you consider the order, delta might contain some particular curve sigma as one of its components. So if you consider the order of vanishing of sigma along, of F along sigma, the order of vanishing of G along sigma, and the order of vanishing of this quantity 4F cubed plus 27G squared along sigma, then those three integers will determine the type of singularity, they determine a surface singularity, and it's a surface singularity of ADE type. Well, if it's not ADE type, then if it's worse than ADE type, then we're not going to end up with a Calabi-Yau manifold, and we sort of stop. So there's sort of a nice table. This Kadaira classification gives us a table. And so I want to pick out for you how to get the singularity of type E8. So over here, E8 was a Lie group, and over here, it's a singularity. So why am I associating a Lie group to a singularity? Well, one of the things that happens in this ADE classification of singularities of surfaces is that when you resolve the singularities, you end up with a diagram of rational curves with the property that its intersection matrix reproduces the combinatorics of the Dinkin diagram of the corresponding Lie algebra. So here I've drawn 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oops. Here I've drawn 8 curves. And if you look at the intersection properties, well, it's more common in Dinkin diagram language to use a point instead of one of these rational curves. So this is meaning 3 guys, and one of them is meaning 2 others, and the other is meaning a bunch of others until I get to 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that's the combinatorial structure. And there were good arguments starting in the mid-90s about why a singularity of a surface of this type should be associated, for example, when you're compactifying M theory, to a gauge group of the corresponding type in the compactification. So for the E8, it turns out that the condition is that F has to vanish to order 3, G has to vanish to order 4, this guy has to vanish to order, excuse me, 4, 5, and 10. This guy has to vanish to order 10. And so I can write down, just to the, as a one-parameter family, I can easily write down y squared equals x cubed plus, I'm going to suppress this term because I don't really need it. The thing is really governed by the fact that I've got t to the fifth here. And that turns out to be the equation which is associated to E8. So it's a beautiful exercise which everybody studying algebraic geometry should do at least once in their life to blow up that singularity and obtain this configuration of curves. It, as you can imagine, takes a little bit of work, but it's fun. So that's the singularity associated to the E8 singularity, and it's one which we're going to associate to E8 gate symmetry. And the point-like instanton shows up when I add another parameter, and when that other parameter is allowed to vanish. So S equals 0 is the point-like instanton. In fact, there's a slightly more general model of this point-like instanton that you can write down from the F-theory perspective. You write down an arbitrary G of degree 4, homogeneous of degree 4 in two variables. That's an F, sorry. Arbitrary F and an arbitrary G, homogeneous of degree 6 in two variables. And that equation represents the point-like instanton, although it may not show the E8 gauge symmetry explicitly when you write it down that way. Okay, so what are these singularities that I'm showing? These are singularities which are a little bit beyond the singularities that we've been discussing so far, in that in order to resolve them, I have to take my base, which is now a two-dimensional base with coordinates S and T. I have my particularly singular point with multiplicity at least 4 here and at least 6 here. And what I'm supposed to do in order to get a Calabi-Yau-type total space is do the operation, which in algebraic geometry is known as blowing up. So I replace the point with a P1 that represent the complex tangent directions, the holomorphic tangent directions, to the original point. There's a standard way of doing that. Maybe new coordinates. You actually need to cover it with two coordinate charts now to discuss the coordinates completely. Yes.
Is there a six manifold implicit in your picture?
Yeah, there is. I've got my F and my G parameterized by the base, and now I've got this.
Since you have this elliptic vibration over your ST manifold.
Over my ST manifold.
And is the K3 surface anywhere?
It's a K. If I just chose, you know, P1s within B, then I might see K3 surface.
Okay.
And there's an additional parameter here, which is the area, so let me call this curve E, which is the area of E. So in algebraic geometry, we're not used to keeping track of areas of things, but in fact, we need a metric on that base as well, and we need to keep track of the area. So this is really a continuous operation, even though it's usually portrayed in algebraic geometry as a discrete operation. It's a continuous operation replacing a point by a growing P1, which as it approaches zero size, returns you back to the point. So this equation in F theory represents one of my 6D superconformal points. It's a point which I can describe a little more conveniently by looking at the blown-up model where I had this -1 curve. And then now S and T serve as homogeneous coordinates on that P1. So I end up describing a nice family of elliptic curves over the P1. And the key thing to make sure that it was conformal is that I can blow back down to get to that blown-down point. So there's now a general argument which says start with an arbitrary base, start with some collection of curves which may be complicated on that base, C1 up through CK, with the property that the entire collection can be shrunk down to a point by varying the metric on the base in an appropriate way. Doing this algebraic geometry operation of shrinking something to a point, although I should say that in this more general situation now, I will allow the point to be a singular point of the surface B. So I will I sort of get forced into looking at singularities. And when I think about that, essentially I'm able to rescale the picture of my elliptic vibration away from that singular point in some sense. And that rescaling process turns out to decouple the gravitational theory that was implicit in this and leave me with a pure field theory. So this is the basic construction of the superconformal field theories that we use. We find singular points of basis together with appropriate S and Gs defining well-behaved elliptic vibrations, or we can think of them as starting from a non-singular surface and a collection of curves which can be contracted to a point, again with the constraint that I've got to be able to find the F and the G, which give me a well-defined family of elliptic curves over the thing. And then in this kind of rescaling limit where the collection of Cs shrinks to a point and everything else scales away, I end up with only the six-dimensional theory decoupled from gravity left over. So the two deformation directions, the one that corresponded to moving the M5 brain away, is actually exactly giving a non-zero area to that blowing up process. And the one that corresponded to going to a non-singular heterotic model corresponds to relaxing my conditions on the equation. Once I've let either F or G have lower degree than is given there, then I have a perfectly non-singular model without needing to do the blow-ups in order to understand what the model is. So that led to a classification program, which actually easily could have been formulated in the 90s. I'm sure Aspinwall and I discussed doing this in the 90s, but it just looked computationally prohibitive to do it in the 90s. But the problem is, classify all collections of curves, C1 through CK, which are contractible, and which admit good enough F and G in their neighborhood. And good enough, so what do I mean by good enough? If I allow F and G to have singularities that are just way too severe, then when I form that elliptically fibered complex threefold over the base, I'll discover that I've lost the Calabi-Yau property or any hope of producing Calabi-Yau by blowing up singularities. So there are some things which would make F and G to be too bad to be considered in this case. But that's basically the problem. And it looks like a very difficult problem because of the need to classify all of these things. There was a kind of intermediate step, which was that about 5 years ago, maybe more like four, about 4 years ago, Waddy Taylor and I, we classified curve collections, CIs, such that F and or G is forced to vanish on CI to some multiplicity. And that turned out to be a sort of important key in getting a handle on this big program. So the result of the big program, I had a bunch of numbers, but the 1502 whatever paper, well, the 1312 paper, I should say, had a cute result, which I will just mention. The 1312 paper sort of classified what all the C possible configurations of C's were, and they found that if you blow down this collection, what you get is C2 mod a group that I'm going to call gamma tilde, just to make clear it's a different class, where gamma tilde is a finite subgroup of U2, not SU2. So there is a broader class of singularities which can occur on the base for these F30 models. And one of the odd things about this result is that not every finite subgroup of U2 occurs. We have a Mathematica notebook which can tell you, given a group, whether it's one of the groups or not. But we don't have an elegant characterization of what class of subgroups of U2 are actually occurring in this problem. So that's still kind of an open issue. But what we finished in February was this complete classification. And it's a complete classification of all of the 60 theories which can be produced by this F-theory method. So I want to make two remarks about this. The first is that already here there's an interesting thing to observe, which is that I told you a large family of possible equations which were associated to a single superconformal theory. Namely, I said I could take any sufficiently generic homogeneous degree 4 polynomial and homogeneous degree 6 polynomial, and I will get that one point-like instanton theory which has no parameters itself. So in the picture of my RG flow, what must be happening is that I'm writing down this collection of models where I vary the parameters. So here I'm going to vary the coefficients of F and G. And then these are all sort of going to the actual theory that I want. And so I should think that whatever this construction is, it is slightly more ultraviolet than the superconformal field theory that I'm headed for. So I'm describing this as using string theory to produce the ultraviolet completion. In that scaling process that I discussed, all of these parameters are going to go away, and that scaling process is essentially what's happening when I head for that superconformal field theory. What we don't have at the moment, and which we really need, is a clear way of looking at the equation and saying, this is the equivalence class of field theories that particular equation determines. It's a very tricky point at the moment, and we're hoping to get better understanding of that aspect of the story. but I do want to tell you kind of interesting consequence of the classification that we got, and I'm only going to tell it to you telegraphically because I don't have too much time left.
Can I ask
what
the equivalence relation is in the classification? I mean, surely you want the same subgroup of U2 to appear.
Oh, yeah, but there are many, many other, there are just huge numbers of, so this is not the complete classification, this is the classification of bases. But there are, for example, huge numbers of ways that you must blow up the C2 mod gamma tilde, depending on which of the gauge groups you're getting associated to which curves. I mean, I only told you one line from the Kadira classification, but each of the curves has to be subject to what's going on in the Kadira classification. You have, in the six-dimensional theory, you have this really interesting structure with gauge groups and representations where the curves are meeting. And it's all subject to 6D anomaly cancellation, which is kind of fun. So each one of those has a big zoo of examples associated to it.
So one particular case is the binary Cauchy-Hugo group? Is that
I actually cannot put the binary Cauchy-Hugo group in the base. That's not actually allowed. The only ones that occur here are of A and D, generalized A and D types, turns out. I mean, I told you it wasn't all of them, and I didn't have a good condition for which ones it is, but I can tell you that there are no E types. However, there's going to be a very pretty story with E in just a minute. So if I go back to my kind of heterotic picture for a minute, and think about what it means from this M theory construction to put the point-like instanton at an ADE singularity of the K3 surface. It turns out that the prediction would be that you end up with a global symmetry of the theory. Okay, I haven't really explained that too well, but you end up with some interesting global symmetry of the theory, which is the group G associated with gamma, and then there will be other stuff going on, and then there will be another global symmetry. So this global symmetry is sort of, you could think of it as having come from the possibility of separating the M5 brains away from this place, and then you'll have another symmetry group, which is essentially the commutant of an embedding, or rather a homomorphism, from gamma into E8. So gamma now is a finite subgroup of SU2, and the prediction from this setup would be that there should be superconformal field theories associated to conjugacy classes of homomorphisms from gamma into the Lie group E8, and that you could recognize those by the fact that you have the possibility of an infinite chain here, an arbitrarily long chain here, with a global symmetry of the associated Lie group at one end and of the commutant of the homomorphism from gamma to E8 at the other end. So using our big classification, we were actually able to enumerate those things in all cases where people know what the homomorphisms from gamma to E8 are. So and we found a beautiful correspondence between the homomorphisms, the group homomorphisms from this discrete group into this big Lie group, with the allowed configurations that have the global symmetry of the commutant of gamma. I don't have a notation for that. Commutant of this on the one hand, and this G gamma on the other hand. In particular, about 20 years ago, a mathematician named, his first initial is D, I don't know his first name, Fry, wrote a couple of memoirs of an AMS working on this problem of finding interesting, finding embeddings, or not embeddings, but arbitrary homomorphisms from various finite groups into E8. And he did the binary icosahedral group. So it is known he did the icosahedral, not the binary icosahedral. I misremembered. He did both of them. He did both the icosahedral and the binary icosahedral, and it's known what the conjugacy classes of homomorphisms are, and all of those things appear on our list. In a way, this really complicated combinatorial algebraic geometry problem was solving a group theory problem. It would be really really interesting to understand a more direct path between these two pieces of mathematics.
Are there embeddings of the binary icosahedral group of the EH?
Yes, there are.
It looks like it should have something to do with the Weyl group, the algebra.
This was a guy who... I don't remember who he was studying with, but this thesis work was kind of a part of the spin down of the whole classification of finite groups of machine, right? That these guys had lots of things and they've done the main thing, and now they're looking for other things they could do with their machinery, and this is one of the things that they managed to do. So I think I will stop there and ask the question.
Okay, any more questions?
Question.
I just
sort of was trying to picture the geography here of where the K3 surface was, where the 2, 5, 7, 9 grains are.
Right.
So you explained that in the, so as I understood, the singular situation is the field theory and the non-singular situation is the gravity. The non-singular situation is where the 5 grain moves to the wall. Did I get that right?
So I'm starting out with a gravitational theory, and later I have to figure out how to decouple the gravity from the theory. But
in the gravitational theory, in the gravitational theory, the connection is non-singular.
So in the, just like I was going to allow the K3s to acquire singularities, this type of curvature singularity of the bundle is not fatal for the gravitational theory.
Oh, okay.
So it produces a gravitational theory with some extra features. In particular, it has an extra tensionless string in the theory, which you wouldn't necessarily have expected to see. But okay, we can still analyze it even without that, even with that tensionless string. The problem with treating it as a gravitational theory is that usually one of the arguments for why your arguments about the gravitational theory are valid is that you can scale up. Every metric looks flat at a sufficiently fine scale, and if you've got features like curvature singularities, that stops being true. Mm. So it's a little less trustworthy, the gravitational analysis, but it's the collision of that M5 brain with the M9 brain without doing the complex deformation, which produces, I would say, a sort of enhanced gravitational theory. And now we're going to use that enhanced part as the nucleus of the interesting conformal theory that we built. So one interpretation of this is that I've got a gravity theory and I've got a conformal field theory and I've got them coupled together in some sense. I'm building the conformal field theory by trying to do the decoupling, but the combined theory has aspects of both.
Okay,
well, I'm sure.
Let's back the speaker again.